What's happening, Reds? Jamie Webster here. Just wanted to say, subscribe below. Thank you very much.
Hi everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Liverpool Connection podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Dazza. If you're just tuning in for the first time, I've got my co-host Dee is back in the house. He missed the last one, but I'm glad to see he's back. For all you Americans out there, happy July 4th. I couldn't be more chuffed today. Our next guest is a living legend because one, he's a legend, and second, he's still living. Which is always good.
It helps.
Yeah, it does help, doesn't it? He's won. This just amazes me. We've only won one league championship in 30 years. This man has won seven in 15 years playing for Liverpool. He is a former captain of Liverpool, which... probably one of his proudest moments. Also, England International. The Liverpool Connection welcomes Phil Thompson. Hiya, Phil.
Daz, how are you, mate? Thanks for that. You didn't go too heavy on that then, did you?
No. I want to get straight into it, you know. I could build you up for the next half an hour, but, you know, who wants to listen to me waffle on? I'd rather listen to you waffle on.
Good stuff.
Let's get into it then. You know, early days, before Liverpool, was your mum and dad like into your football?
Yeah, but it's football was the only thing that you had. I was born in Kensington about, probably as you know, Daz, about a mile from Anfield, just there off Holt Road. And we moved up to Kirby when I was about four or five. And as you can imagine, in Kensington, there wasn't a lot of green area. We had what was called a resi, which was an underground reservoir. But it wasn't really a playing area, and on top of it, the grass. So to move to the fertile land of Kirby by sea, was just absolutely wonderful. Our house in Saltine in Kirby, the back of us was a school playing field, which was wonderful to have this greenery, to be able to play football. And in those days, we had like one football, and it was normally one of these plastic ones, not a flyaway as we called it, to play football. And that's all you had. We didn't have sort of other things, cricket, golf, or anything like that to sort of take up our time. It was football. Certainly in the summer holidays from 9 o'clock in the morning till 7, 8 o'clock at night, it was what revolved around it. Not many cars in the road. We could actually play football from one lamppost to the other. So it was a wonderful life. Great growing up in Kirby. Rough, tough area, but it was a good, it was the making of you as a young kid.
So who was your favourite player? Like, you know, playing in the
well, it was great. Just you going on about my mum and dad. My mum was obviously a massive Liverpool fan. She was a twin, massive Liverpool fan. Her and my auntie May went to all the Liverpool games. So that's where my sort of passion for Liverpool came. My dad was a Blue. Oh. He was an Evertonian, but he went away to sea most of my young life. So he sort of came back and forward, 2 weeks away, 2 weeks at home. But there was no way that we were ever going to change. So those early days, particularly sort of when after Bill Shankly came, December, I think, 1959, was the great changing of that love, that passion, that little bit of, and you could see something special sort of arrived at Liverpool and where we were going to go. You could feel it those early days. You knew. Next was promotion from the second division to the first division. And it was great. It was a lovely train to get on. You didn't know where it was going to go to. You didn't care. You were just traveling along with Bill Shankly and those 60s boys who were all my heroes. You know, the Ian St. John, sort of Big Yeatsy, Tommy Smith, Peter Thompson, Ian Callaghan, oh, it goes through me now. Then Willie Steve-O. And a lot of older people will remember these lads, and it was just fantastic. But then there was Roger Hunt. And we all have our hero, don't we? Mm-hmm. Of sort of what you were like and what you knew. But Roger was something different. He was there. And being as a 15-year-old, getting that chance to meet him. And they always say in life, don't they? You should never meet your hero. And why? Because they mightn't be the person that you thought they were going to be. And they might just let you down. Roger never let me down. So those early worshiping days, to at 15 becoming an apprentice, what a wonderful man he was. And it was probably one of the highlights of my life, meeting Roger. I met so many people in my life, but nobody still does it. And he's gone now a short while ago. And it was just the most fantastic experience just to meet and be around Roger Hunt.
Now, did your mum take you to Anfield?
My mum took us to Anfield. We went on our own, my brother Owen and myself. My brother used to give me 50p a week, 10 bob, and I would save that. He only got, I think it was 3.5 quid wages a week, and he'd give me sort of 10 shillings to sort of, as it was then, to go, and I'd save that to sort of go, and 1 week we'd go to match. So it was all growing up that way. But when you say my mum took me, one of the big games that she took me was the Inter Milan game in the 1965, mm-hmm. in the semi-final of the European Cup. And we were right on the front row. We just won the FA Cup the previous Saturday, and she somehow got tickets for Owen and myself. Right, because trying to get tickets for that match, if those people can ever think back and remember it, it was sold out. It was heaving. And we were right on the front row. And Gordon Milne and Jerry Byrne come past us carrying the FA Cup. So for us to be at that game at such importance was just wonderful. So my man pulled out all the stops to get those tickets for us that day. And I must admit, watching the game, we won 3-1 against Inter Milan. My eyes were just glued on the cop, the movement of the cop, being on this side, watching it swaying and everything. And yes, I had the love affair, and I've been in the cop before then, but that love affair from watching them that day was just amazing, absolutely amazing, because you grew up. You grew up going in the boys' pen. Then you sort of elevation to the cop. You know, and I can remember climbing over the drain pipes in the corner of the boys' pen and getting over and having the stewards chasing after you. It was great. But they would always, I was always quick back in the early days.
Can't do that now, eh?
No. I tell you, I've just had my second knee replacement. So I've had my two knees done now, Daz. It's a good job I don't live in the Isle of Man, isn't it?
Oh, man. Yeah, you can't be climbing many Jane pipes now.
No, not half. Not half.
So we come to 17 years of age. You get signed by Liverpool and the big man, you know, Bill Shankly. Again, as I talk to you, you know, on the phone about my granddad and stuff, trying to tell me all those stories and missing out on those. So how... You know, now I've got first, you know, that a player that has actually played under him. I mean, as a 17-year-old, obviously you knew about Bill. And then, you know, having a sit down with him saying, you know, you're signed for Liverpool. That must have been a dream come true.
You can imagine walking those corridors of Anfield, the main stand, because we went to the main stand every day. That's where we'd go after go as an apprentice. And for 2 years, that was going to be my life. So getting the bus from Kirby, arriving at Anfield to go in there, to walk those corridors of the main stand. Because as sort of history has it, we got on a coach, we went down, we'd done our training down at Melwood, we got the coach back, then we bathed there, and then we dined together. So this was all Shanks's vision. And it was wonderful because walking those corridors at Anfield, he was just wonderful. You could hear his voice coming along. Remember those great words? Going to build us up to be a bastion of invincibility. And it was the hairs on the back of my neck. I loved sort of Roger Hunt and everything, but everybody's hero then was Bill Shankly. His words, whenever those little words on the TV or in the papers, it was always positivity, always making you feel special. But there was times when he could make you feel a bit bad, because I can remember him stopping me in the corridor one day and he looked at me and he went, "Jesus Christ, Tomlinson, look at the size of the nose on you. You must have told some lies when you were younger, Pinocchio." And I was like, "Oh my goodness." And you just had to go along with him. And he stopped me one day and he went, "Jesus Christ, Tomo." He says, "You remind me of a racehorse." And I says, "Why is that, boss? Malian, muscly, speedy?" He said, no, son, you'd be great in a photo finish." And I just, my mum, who has said was a great Liverpool fan, she'd be like that to me. She'd be going, "Did the great man speak to you today?" And I'd be thinking, "What the hell can I be telling her today?" But he was wonderful, Daz. Honestly, it was the most incredible time of my life, being able to sort of walk those same corridors of Bill Shankly. He's the one who gave me the chance. He signed me as a professional, as you say, 17 years of age. I'd done me 2 years as an apprenticeship. And I can remember I was injured. And this is December. My birthday's January 21st. And if you want to send me a card. So January 21st. And so it's December and I'm injured. I'm thinking I've had a groin problem for weeks now. And you had no physiotherapist, so you had no rehabilitation coaches. You were left to your own. Yeah, you get a little bit of treatment. When you got down to Melwood, you walked when you could walk. You jogged when you could jog. You ran when you could. And then you could sprint when you could sprint. And then you're fit. So I'm there walking around what was then the B team pitch. And I can remember coming around back towards the old Melwood Pavilion. And Shanks come out of the building and he come walking. I'm thinking, "Oh, please don't let him be coming, walking towards me." And he headed towards me like that. And he looked at me and he beckoned me over. And I thought, because you heard all the stories about Shanks. Anybody was injured, he just didn't want to know you. He blanked you. If you looked in the treatment room, he'd say, "Morning, Bob. Morning, Joe. Morning, Ronnie." Wouldn't even acknowledge the injuries that were in there. I thought, "I'm going to get a bollocking here." And he stopped me and he looked at me and he went, "Hey, Phil, son," he says, "I know it's your birthday, January 21st. He says, "I just want to put your mind at ease. Now listen, don't be telling any of your other apprentices until after your birthday." He says, "But I'm just letting you know because I know you're injured and you'll be worried about what's going to happen. But we believe in you, son. We know that you can be a player. Now we're going to sign your professional forms on the 22nd. Of January, so keep it to yourself. Don't worry, we like you so much." And I was like that, oh my God, I couldn't believe it. And that alleviated all, I think it helped in my convalescence of getting myself fitter, just having that free of mind. Those wonderful words, I sort of never forgot, because then I was 17, I was starting on my journey to play for Liverpool and do all what I did.
So when did the conversation about steak and chips happen?
Steak and chips, he always loved to, we had steaks galore in the dining room that we always had. And he would be all the young, like particularly me who was being skinny. But the greatest story about the steaks was another Kirby lad, John McLaughlin. And John was a really good player just before my time. Got into the first team and he got a girl pregnant who worked down at Melwood. He used to do the tea on a Tuesday and Thursday night. And he got the girl pregnant. And of course, he'd been building John up because he needed to fatten up. So John had to go and see him this day and said, "Excuse me, boss, I'm going to have to get married in midweek and everything." And he went, "Jesus Christ." And he said, "Well, I've got two, she's pregnant." And he's going, "Jesus Christ, son, I've been feeding you these fillet steaks, trying to build you up. What have I done? I've created a monster." And he absolutely smashed John down. I think that was the reason why he didn't last too long, John McLaughlin. But he just loved it. And I always believed in steaks, even when I played when I became assistant manager, the players would be on fish, on chicken, boiled chicken, things like this. I still had a fillet steak in memory of Bill Shankly.
Steve.
Hey, good morning, Joe. Hey, I wanted, you know, we've had a lot of the ex-players come on and talk about their experiences with the team, especially the ones that had grown up around the Liverpool area. And, you know, signing the forms obviously is an amazing part of the journey. But take us back to your debut. I know your debut at Old Trafford coming on in, and then in the first time you stepped on it at Anfield as a professional.
Well, the early days, do you know what? I don't even know what was my debut was against Manchester United at Old Trafford, 1972. I'm 18 years of age. Never got in the first team, been with them a couple of times, only one sub in those days. And we're there at Old Trafford. So this is massive. George Best, Bobby Charlton. It is an absolute fantastic team. And I can remember running up and down the touchline. And Jordan, the second half, probably about 20 minutes to go. And I'm running up and down the touchline. John Toshak gets a bang on the head. And he's staggering on the pitch. And I'm jogging along the touchline. And I'm looking at Tosh and I'm thinking, oh, please be all right. Oh, please be all right. Don't be coming off. It's Old Trafford. And he's gone like that. And he starts walking over towards the touchline. And then I can see Shanks beckoning me. Tomo, come here, son. Come here. Get your tracksuit off. And I thought, no. We're winning 2-0, by the way, so it shouldn't have been a problem. So he says, get your tracksuit. Now, these tracksuits were not like they are now. You know, zips right the way up to the knee. You know, the tops come off very easy. This was a tracksuit that you have to get, obviously, over your head, quite tight on the head. Get that off. But then trying to get the tracksuit bottoms off, which are just elasticated ankles like that. So I'm trying to get them over my boots. I'm stumbling. I'm panicking inside. I'm stumbling. The Liverpool, traveling Liverpool fans must have been thinking, what the hell is this coming on? So then I goes like that. And he goes, right, Thomas, and Tosh is coming off. He says, I want you to go and play just behind Kevin. We're winning 2-0. Kevin will play centre forward. You play in behind him like a number 10, because I was a midfield player then. And he says, you know, Callie and Emlyn will be behind you. And he says, I want you to play in there, son. He says, right, on you go. So goes on, right in the centre circle. I'm like that. Who gets the ball confronts me. Now, as you know, in my playing days, or if you did not, I was a very clever footballer. If anything, I was so clever. So who gets the ball approaches me right on the centre circle. Centre spot, George Best. George comes towards me like that. I offered him the chance to nutmeg me. He took the opportunity, but I closed my shins very, very quickly. The ball hit my shins and off I went with the ball. That was my first touch in professional football, off George Best. And many years later, George and myself ends up working together on Soccer Saturday. And honestly, it was one of the best moments of my life. So, of course, when we were out getting drunk, when we were having Saturday nights out and everything in London, did I tell him once? I must have told him 200 times. And he was like that. Not again, Tomo. Please don't tell me that story again. Absolute bored that often. And it was. But it was one of the great moments of my life. We won the game 3-0 and nearly scored. Went past Martin Buchan, left foot drive. Alex Stepney, full-length save, tipped it round the post, and I nearly, for the first time, the travelling Liverpool fan sang my name. You can imagine that as an 18-year-old. It doesn't get much better. So that, playing against them, was just sensational. So beating them 3-0 was a great, great feeling.
You know, imagine growing up in Liverpool, and you're not going to have your debut at Anfield, but you have it at Old Trafford. You know, I guess, you know, having it at Everton, maybe just kind of equal, but, you know, and beating, you know, Manchester United in that game, it has to be just a great experience. But when you go back to Anfield, your first time playing in front of your locals, you know, some of the friends that you grew up with, the families that had season tickets, and that had to be quite the experience there.
Well, do you know, Anfield was always some of the one of the greatest things in my life, of to have that opportunity to run out there playing in the red of Liverpool. It's what you've dreamed about. And I must admit, when I was those 2 years as an apprentice, I was just blown away by the whole scenario, being cleaning football boots, putting the kit away, putting it out, cleaning bats, cleaning floors. Yes, I wanted to play for Liverpool, but it didn't consume me. I was just so glad to be there. But then when you get beyond 17, you become a professional, then you have these challenges in your life and you start thinking, I want to do this, I want to do this. And the boy, John McLaughlin, I can remember John when he made his debut down at Chelsea. I remember asking him, what was it like? 54,000 down at Stamford Bridge. What was it like? And he was saying, oh, it was great. Once the game started off, he said it was as though nobody was there. And that's exactly what happens. But playing at Anfield, one of my big things with every game that I played at Anfield, I told you before, my brother Owen and I used to stand same place on the cot. Obviously, we never ended up in that same place because we were all over the place. When I came out onto the pitch, I'd always look up and Owen would stand in exactly the same place as where he and I stood, and I would wave to him every time. So you can imagine that. Like the first time I became captain of Liverpool, 1978, I'm looking up and I'm like that. I'm in the dressing room. Bob Paisley's only told me an hour before the game that I'm captain. Now, I'm now sort of 24 years of age. I'm thinking this was in my destiny. I was meant to be Liverpool captain. Oh, but he's told me an hour before kickoff. So no mobile phones. So can't ring my parents or Owen. Owen's going to be in the Alberts in the pub. Can't tell anybody. So I'm thinking, I'm going to go out. Got to make sure we're playing Arsenal at Anfield. I'm thinking, I need to make sure we get out early. Because back in the day, it's not like what people see on Sky now. Once you were ready, you could go down those tunnels. You could get whichever end that you wanted to be. So sometimes the away side, get out there first and get in the Liverpool end, in the cop end, to upset us straight away. So I'm thinking, right, I need to wave to our own. I'm captain for the first time. I'm now. So there's about 8 minutes to go to kick off to 3 o'clock. I'm saying to all the lads, right, lads, come on. I think we need to get out there. And they're all going, Tomo, we know you're excited. Just please calm down. Just this is, you know, you've got to sort of take. And I go, okay. So it's about 6 minutes to go, 5 minutes, the bell's going to go. I'm going, boys, we need to get out there. We need to get. And like that, soon as that, they, look, Tomo, just wait a minute. Just, I said, lads, we got, okay, all right, let's go. So he comes out the dressing room. Everybody, come on, let's go do it. Comes out the dressing room, down the steps, touches the This Is Anfield sign, comes up, turns, runs towards the cop end. I'm looking for our own. I'm captain of Liverpool for the first time. I get stared to the edge of the box, looking to Owen like that, waving up to him as I always did. And the whole of the ground's laughing. And I'm thinking, what's going on here? What's happening? I turned around, looked back. There's Ray Clements, Kenny Dalglish, Graeme Smith, Teddy McDermott. They're still in the tunnel area. They're absolutely pissing themselves laughing at Soft Lad, who's in the middle of the pitch on his own. And I thought it was a wonderful moment because they knew how important it was to me. And they were having a laugh at my expense, but they knew it was one of the biggest moments of my life.
You know, that's a great story. You've had so many great moments, obviously, you know, guys that alluded to the seven league titles and you've won three European Cups. Now, it's probably hard to kind of winnow it down to your top three experiences on the pitch, but we'll ask you anyway.
Well, the top three, people ask, probably in third place is FA Cup final, 1974. Sort of playing at Wembley, 20 years of age, just the most thing. The FA Cup was, I still love the FA Cup now, but it doesn't seem to have that sort of love that it had back then. Because it was on at 10 o'clock in the morning and everybody, we always watched it, whether Liverpool were in it or not, which we weren't much. It was obviously 1965. Under Shanks, we won our first one, which is still one of my greatest ever memories. So to go back there, we got beaten 71 against Arsenal. So to go back there in 74 was huge. I'm 20. I can remember the day of the game, going down for my breakfast, round about 9:30, 10 o'clock, and I rushed my breakfast, had my breakfast. I was rooming with a guy called Alan Waddle. And as I'm rushing back out, I can remember Brian Hall, God bless him. And he turned to me and he said, "What are you doing, Tom? Where are you going? What are you in a hurry for?" I went, "The road to Wembley's on the television." he said, "You're playing in it." And I went, "I know, but I always watch it." So that was the experience. But then to play against Malcolm McDonald and a guy called John Tudor, the other centre forward, and what Malcolm wasn't going to do to Emlyn Hughes and myself, which wound us up, the likes of Joe Fagan and Ronnie Moran, who was like the reserve team, but they had all cutouts and everything of what Malcolm McDonald was going to do to us. So, of course, I marked him. He had two shots on the day. One went about 10 foot over the bar. Then the other one went about sort of 20 yards wide. It was the only two things. And I ended up man of the match. And it was the most incredible. And Malcolm's still in my top pocket now, by the way. And it was just that. So that's three. Second place has got to be 19. Everybody asks, seven league titles, what was your best? And it has to be 1976 at Molineux, the home of Wolverhampton Wanderers. We need 1 point to win the league. They need to beat us to have a chance of staying in the first division. So this is massive. It's on a Tuesday night. QPR, who was in second place, who needed us to get beat, they'd already finished the league campaign on the Saturday before. So we've gone to Molineux. And it is absolutely packed. And if you know the geography then of Molineux, where it was, the players' entrance was right on the corner of the stadium. So the coach would park. You'd literally got out. You walk across the pavement. There's a big six-foot-wide door. That was the dressing room in the corner of the stadium. So we arrived there about quarter past that, past six, the day of the game. As the coach is coming along the road to the dressing room, I looked, and it is packed. We haven't won the league for 3 years, 72, 73. We're now 3 years on, and it is packed. People have travelled from Merseyside. They are absolutely, you could just pay at the turnstiles. So as I'm travelling, I'm thinking, I hope Owen and Ian, my two brothers, again, Owen's older, Ian's younger. I thought, I hope they've got in to see this match. Gets there, coach parks up, gets into the dressing room. I goes in the dressing room. We're all having a chat. He goes out onto the pitch to have a look at the pitch, as we always did. It's packed. Molineux is absolutely chock-a-block. I'm looking around like that. Oh, my God, it's full. Liverpool fans were on three sides of the ground. So I've gone back in the dressing room. I'm thinking, I hope Owen and Ian and a few of the lads from the Falcon and Kirby have got in to the game. So anyway, getting changed. It's about sort of 5:10 past 6. There's a knock on the door. Phil Thompson. I said, that's me, lad. He says, your brothers, Owen and Ian, are outside the main entrance, just up in the middle of the stadium. I've gone, no. So I've put a tracksuit on. I've ran up the middle of the corridor, gets to the front door. Owen's outside. He's standing there looking at me. Now, he knows this match is absolutely massive for me. So I'm thinking, he's going to be nice and cool and calm. Owen's waiting there. Kid, I'm telling you now, you make sure you get us in. We've not missed a match all season. You get us into this game. We have been up and down the country watching Liverpool. We're going to win the league tonight. You get us in. Don't care how you do it. We get in to this match. I've gone, shit. Oh, my God. I've gone like that. I'll tell you what, kid. Go down by the players' entrance. You can't miss it. Just down there in the corner. And I said, I'll go and see what I can do. And goes back in the dressing room. Bob Paisley standing there. Is everything all right, Phil? And I went, no, boss. But what's the problem? I said, boss, you've got to do me a favour. I said, me brothers Owen and Ian have been locked out. And I says, they can't get in everywhere. All the gates are shut. And he went, well, what do you want me to do? And I said, boss, get the keys off the lad. Open that door. I've had a word with the steward and the police officer just here. They're going to let me brothers in to the paddock just there because they can't afford to miss this match. I can't do that. I can't open that. I could see him looking at me, and he's gone, I need Tomo in the best frame of mind possible. I need to help him out. So he goes to the fella, give me the keys. Starts to open the door. I jumped up on the bench, looked out the window. Oh, and Ian, lads, get in. So they came in our own, come through the dressing room like that. And he went, I knew you'd do it, kid. I knew you'd get us in. They came in, and the lads from the Falcon, and then another 10 fellas behind them came in. And then another 10 fellas behind them, they're all walking in, going through the ground. Good luck, Kevin. Good luck, Clem. Good luck, Lance, and everything. But Paisley's got his shoulder next to the door like that. He's going, Jesus Christ, Tomo, how many brothers have you got? Oh, my God. It's gone down as legend amongst all the lads. So that was number two. Number three has to be European Cup final. 1981. Real Madrid in Paris. We've just been there, haven't we? Mm-hmm. In Paris. But this was the Parc des Princes. And the all whites against the all reds. And we were a bigger team than Real Madrid back then. We were a bigger team in world football. Mm-hmm. So to play them in Paris and have that opportunity to do what Emlyn had done in 77 and 78. And as I say, being captain was one thing. But being captain of the European Cup winning side, the first Scouser to lift the European Cup. And to do it, Alan Kennedy's goal, 7 minutes from the end of that game. I don't know what he was doing up there, like, but for him to score that goal and give me the opportunity to lift the European Cup was one of the great moments in my life. And we always believed that the league title was the most important thing. But that one moment in my life, I have all the pictures in my house of lifting it. And if you see the guy, the old UEFA guy, he shakes my hand like that, and I shakes his hand. And then he lifts the, and he goes to lift the European Cup like that. And I go like that. I go, give me the cup here. And it, because this was my moment, not your moment. And I lift it. And I lifted it straight over to where all the lads were from the Falcon, my brothers and everything, all in the right in the upper tier over in the far side. But it doesn't get much better. And I even took the European Cup back to the Falcon on the Thursday night after we'd done the trip down the city.
Amazing stories, that's for sure.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah. this week's been a big week for Liverpool, you know, signing of Mo Salah, you know, extending his contract. And it reminded me that when you retired when you were 31, relatively early in terms mm-hmm. Of football. And, you know, all the ex-players that we've had on the show, that we always ask them, you know, how was that decision made? You know, it can't be a fun time to know that your playing career has come to an end. Did you have any regrets? Do you think you could have pushed on for a couple more seasons?
Well, Steve, it's I moved on to Sheffield United then, and that I went there on a loan move, and I felt that I should really have been playing, getting a chance back in the side, and Joe Fagan wasn't picking me, and I was really upset. And lo and behold, Ian Portfield at Sheffield United came one day, and I thought, right, I'm going to go. It had upset me that much. So I went, I had 1 month, then I had another month, then I had another month. And I ended up signing for 18 months at Sheffield United. So I did prolong my career a little bit. But then when Kenny Dalglish offered me that chance to become a player reserve team manager, that doesn't often come along too often. Now, I was training at Sheffield Monday, Wednesday, Friday. But I was training at Liverpool Tuesdays and Thursdays. So I would be doing a little bit of training, but I'd be in the famous staff games, famous five-a-sides on Little Wembley with Kenny, with Ronnie Moran, with all them. So, of course, you were there and you were trying to help out the young lads. And maybe Kenny had seen something in me. And he stopped me one day and he said, listen, he said, if it doesn't go right at Sheffield United for you, I want you back here as a coach. So I didn't know what he wanted. So a couple of weeks later, when I said, were you serious about that, Ken? And he said, yeah. He said, if you're going to leave Sheffield United, I want you to be the player manager of the reserve team. So it was a wonderful offer. So, you know, at 32, your legs are not the same. I'd had a couple of cartilage operations. And I thought, and that was keeping me going more than my legs were. And I thought, this is probably the time's right. And I always wanted to get involved in coaching. So to have that opportunity, and if I'd not have taken it, it would have gone to somebody else and it might never have come my way again. So it was too good an opportunity not to take up at a relatively young age.
You know, we just had Sammy Lee on a couple of weeks ago, and obviously he got into management and he's still there and he's had a great time. And you spent some years under Julier as well. And I imagine the experience is different winning trophies as part of the management staff than it is as a player. It's got to be a unique experience for you winning it, those trophies with the Reds.
Do you know what? It was a great time. And that came out of the blue for Gerard Houllier and myself. You know, Graham Sinise had sacked me in 1992, which I was absolutely devastated with. But then I got that opportunity 6 years later. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing all my TV work. I've been doing a lot of radio work. You know, Sky's television started in 1992. And so it was quite fortunate in that respect. But then getting that telephone call, and obviously we had the ill-fated Roy and Gerard joint manager's role, was never working, was never going to work. And then just getting that phone call that would I go to a meeting of all the staff, and they said Roy's resigning and they wanted me to be assistant manager with Gerard Houllier. God bless him. And I had the most wonderful 6 years. Yes, the wheels came off in the end, but we won trophies. We won five trophies in 6 months. Mm-hmm. We brought the first European Cup, European trophy to Anfield in, 16 or 17 mm-hmm. years. So there's a generation of Liverpool fans that only hear of the iconic stories of mm-hmm. travelling for a European final. And now it was their chance, going to Dortmund, was playing Alaves, and what a game it was. You know, 5-4 with the golden goal and winning the FA Cup against Arsenal. Arsenal battering us for like 75, 80 minutes and Michael Owen scoring the goals. So it was a wonderful occasion and something that I remember ever so well. And I don't feel Gerard Houllier gets the credit that he should do for bringing that Trebler and Carragher and Steven Gerrard, they still say that was one of the greatest moments of their time. Yes, Istanbul came along. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why fans look as though Benitez was the saviour to sort of take the club after Gerrard. But Houllier was wonderful. And he should be remembered because he changed the culture mm-hmm. at Liverpool. We'd gone at the Spice Boy era and we'd come through that. The lunatics were running the asylum. And this needed grasping back. And I knew what my role was. I was ready and willing to play that. I was the aggressor. I was the one. Because you couldn't have two people like Gerard Houllier. So I was the one who got right into the ribs of all the players. We needed changing. We needed that attitude. We needed that discipline to take us forward. But Gerard changed the whole thing, the whole stuff about how we trained. It was all timed, all done things like that, which took a while for the players to get their heads around. The diets, we stopped the alcohol in the players' lounges and after games. So the likes of Klopp and all those people who came after them should be beholden to Gerard mm-hmm. for what he actually did.
Yeah, it seems like he and Arsene Wenger really changed the dynamics of
absolutely
just the coaching, the methodology, right, of that time.
It was different for the players because when I'd arrived, it was November 1998. So Roy and Gerard had gone from the pre-season to that particular time, 1998, to November. So it was very much sort of the players. Houllier never even done any of the coaching. Mm-hmm. And that was the thing because he felt like he didn't want to intrude a little bit. And that wasn't right. So as soon as he took over, it was wham, right, this is what's going to happen. We had like 6 minute sessions, 6 minutes doing this, 6 minutes doing that, and then it was over. The small sided games, which were famous, but this was a different team. This needed more than just small sided games, having a kick about, you know, sort of compete eight a side across the pitch. This and these players needed a little bit more coaching because we were drifting. Mm-hmm. So lo and behold, Gerard changed it. The five asides at the end were like 6 minutes long. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I was thinking, is this right? But it left the players wanting more. And I think that was important. He wanted them to be competitive. And they ended up, we ended up having to get the players to wear shin pads in training because it was so competitive. So, yes, I think Coulier's should be absolutely revered by the club.
You know, I just want to go back to, you know, signing Salah has kind of really opened up a conversation thread of people that say, you know, money's getting out of hand in football. And a lot of that, you kind of really can trace back to Sky and the invention of the Premier League. You know, when you started there at Sky, really at the very beginning of the Premier League era, and kind of take us back through what you've seen and how you obviously enjoyed your time there, you know, as a pundit, and just always interested in hearing anybody's takes that works in the media as well.
Yeah, it's a difficult one, isn't it? It's gone mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. The money and the salaries that these guys get. But it was like that, wasn't it? We find that things were leveling out. If you remember back in 2004, just as we were finishing with Gerard Houllier, along come Abramovich, and the transfer fees just went absolutely off the scale. And we thought there was a bit of normality. That, as you say, along with the Premier League coming in, beaming it out, satellite, sending it out all across the world, was just... So, of course, sponsors wanted to get on the back of this. You know, you wouldn't say back then, 1992, that the league, as it was then, was the best in the world. You know, you had the Italians who were... they were taking in, the Spanish were taking all the best players in. Then all of a sudden, because of the Premier League and the money that was getting by sponsors getting thrown at it, the bigger the wages started coming. Abramovich came in, started bigger transfer fees. So you say, what's right or wrong? And the clubs are making a lot of money. You look for Mo Salah. I thought we'd lost him. I thought he was going to leave on a free transfer, if I'm perfectly honest. I am so glad I was wrong. Because him signing, do you know what the biggest signing was? And it's not Darwin Nunes, it's not Fabio Cavalli or anything. It was Jurgen Klopp. Mm-hmm. Because he's the catalyst behind all this. That's why Mo, I'm sure if we'd have had another manager or Jurgen hadn't committed himself, he's mm-hmm. probably thinking, well, the end of next season, he's going to be gone after that. So why do I want to hang around? So the Jurgen Klopp signing was huge, absolutely huge for the club. And you look at the financial side with Mo Salah, but what we'd have to do to try and replace somebody like him, I think is astronomical. And I don't know what the stumbling point was, because we were all thinking as Liverpool fans, he's probably going to cost $350,000 a week. He's probably due that for what he's done, where he's took us, winning these trophies. And that's what he signed for. So you're going, well, what was holding it back for so long? I'm scratching my head. Is there something else, which I suppose it has gone on in the background? So, but to where our football club's gone in the last few years is quite sensational. I was up at the AXA training facility. I got taken around there by Alex Inglethorpe, who's the academy director. Before the team were coming back today, I had a look around. Oh, my goodness. I think back when I was a kid, the old Melwood, and then the new Melwood, which Gerard Houllier and myself built, state-of-the-art training facility. This was incredible. This was mind-blowing. And it's something that our football club deserves. And it shows that next step. And as I did with some of the other staff, we went around a few of the clubs who had built new training facilities. Our club did exactly the same, but they went throughout Europe having a look. And now, honestly, it is so good. It is absolutely brilliant. There's a lot in there because if you want that real working class, there's a lot of things which are wood and metal. Nothing like polished stone and all this, which is a little bit aloof. Mm-hmm. A lot of thought's gone into the infrastructure.
Yeah, no, and I know some of our listeners will remember this, but I've met you before at Kirby. I played in a Legends match, and you're one of the gaffers on the side. So I have a picture of me, you, and Carragher on the bench at halftime, and it's one of my prized mementos.
Still remember, you had a nightmare.
You didn't look too happy in that photograph either.
You have your arms crossed like this.
I did.
It's a funny story. So I wanted, when we were able to bring you on, I just was very happy because that was my first trip to Liverpool. That was my first day in the city. We had the match. I literally just got in from Manchester like an hour before that. So I hadn't slept, and it was, you know, walking into that train center, and this was before AXA, right? This was, you know, the old Kirby train center.
Was that called the Dream? When people come from different parts of the country, or was it the Anfield Experience?
That was through the 23 Foundation, the charity match. But but you're like really the first person I met on that trip that was, you know, one of the legends. You always have a special place in my heart there, Tom.
Oh, thank you very much.
But, you know, going back that, but, you know, when that was 2016, or I think, and they hadn't obviously converted to the new training academy, but I've heard stories at that training academy. It's just amazing.
Do you know what? It's lovely for me as well, being a Kirby lad, you know, and spending all my youth in Kirby, and to see now that we have our academy there. Mm-hmm. And now we have our first team and under 23 training facility on the same grounds that I run a Sunday league team. Mm-hmm. From the age of 21 to 33. I was running a Sunday league team on those pitches up mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. And of course, the club bought all that area. Mm-hmm. And now they're on that same patch. And it's so, for me to see all that coming to Kirby, it's just absolutely fantastic. It really is. And I say it does our club justice. To have such a facility.
Yes, I know Dazza wants to get back. I had one more question though. You taught a
he doesn't half talk, Steve does.
Yeah. So you taught a course at the college there on football matters in the MBA program. I was curious about what that was about.
Do you know what? I don't do it anymore. We drifted apart. But it was nice down at the university. I used to go down there, and I would go down like once a month, mm-hmm. chat to the students. And it was amazing because these people come from all over the world to come and gain this experience. And some of the guys had gone on to work for FIFA, for UEFA, for football clubs in different things, like sort of ticketing, merchandise, do different. So it was wonderful. It gave them a great insight. Do you know what I found? A lot of them, and it cost them a lot of money. These were more mature students. I found that it was a love for Liverpool what brought them to the city, to be able to come to Liverpool and be at this hub, obviously the home of the Beatles, home of, you know, wonderful, be on that sort of the River Mersey. There's so much vibrant about it. And people came, were drawn to it. But then you've got Liverpool, you've got Everton, you've got Manchester United, you've got Manchester City. You've got so much happening in the Northwest, but it was the draw of Liverpool Football Club, I would say, for probably 90% of them. But they all walked away with a degree. And I'd try and help them with placements of football clubs from me being involved at Liverpool. So I would make phone calls with a guy called Wogan Taylor, and things like that. Brian Barwick, who was head of the BBC, of ITV, and then he was involved in the FA. So it was a nice time, but I don't do as much now. Mm-hmm. But it was a wonderful opportunity to do something different and to talk and chat to people from, obviously, different cultures.
Well, yeah. Phil, I wanted to ask you, you know, again, you've worked with Shankly and Paisley, but you quote Ronnie Moran as your mentor. What was it about Ronnie that really hit, you know, home for you?
Well, Daz, Ronnie was obviously a great player at the end of the 50s through to the middle, late 60s. And him becoming a coach sort of evolved as me as a player, as a young kid. And there was a fellow called Tony Waiters, who was like the first youth development officer, and Ronnie Moran. And they would be taking care of us kids. So Tony Waiters would be like with the A team, Ronnie would be with the B team. So Ronnie helped me, and he was a tough taskmaster, was Ronnie. And he was so hard that you felt you'd never please him. But he was just, so he brought me through from the B team, the A team, the reserve team, to the first team. Our careers, his coaching, my footballing career, took off together. So he gave me the most wonderful advice. And he would be nurturing me along the way. So all this in my life was revolved around him. My coaching life took what Ronnie had brought to the game. Because when he was with the first team, I was like that. And even as strong men as Graeme Sness, Kenny Dalglish, we'd win 5-0 on a Saturday. And we'd come in on a Monday morning, and Ronnie would be like a bear with a sore head. Ah, get over here, right? We're going to run. If you're not going to do things properly, we'll get over here and run. And you'd be going, there's nothing ever pleased this fella. But you know, as you get a little bit older and you see it in him, and why he does it is, if you don't have that person who's that driving force, everybody can get carried away the way our success was. But this guy had his feet on the ground, and he drove us to success time and time again. And I was advocating for Ronnie. He wasn't just for me, but for, I always believe he was our greatest ever coach. And you go, well, what about Shanks? What about Bob and everything? They were managers. They did things in different ways. They picked the teams. And our coach was Ronnie Moran, and what he brought to that coaching. When we did those small-sided games, one and two touch, pass, run forward. I believe that AXA training centre should have been called a Ronnie Moran training complex as sort of what he achieved for our football club. So that's it. So I do have great affection for Ronnie. And it was lovely at his funeral. His family asked me to do his football eulogy. Mm. That is him. He had all the great and good of Liverpool Football Club. And I said those words, that if and when this training complex opens, I hope that Ronnie Moran is acknowledged. And I certainly hope one day something significant gets done in Ronnie's name.
Yeah, I feel the same way for Houllier as well. Both Ronnie and Gerard aren't, you know, put up against the likes of Shankly and Paisley. You know, you see on a lot of photo, like pictures of people drawn and stuff. I even have one that's got, you know, Rafa, Benitez, Klopp, and there's no Houllier, and there's no Ronnie Moran. It's weird to me.
There's a big flag in the bottom corner of the cop as you look from the pitch, the bottom left-hand corner. It's a big white one, and it's got all the managers' heads silhouetted onto this thing, and it's got Shanks, Bob, Joe, Kenny, Rafa. There's like five people there, and Jürgen. And there's no Gerard Houllier. And I think, why is that? This was a fella, as I just explained to Steve, brought the first European trophy, put smiles back on people's faces, had them with pride wearing their shirts in the summer going on the holidays throughout that 2001 season. And it was wonderful. Yes, the wheels come off as it did with Rafa. Mm-hmm. But yet Rafa, because of what happened in 2005, and I think, and I've made my feelings known about it, and I just can't get my head round, is that he's not given. And a number of times I've spoke to people, they've gone, yeah, that's Houllier. Well, and you go, why did he do? Did he do something? The guy nearly gave his life for Liverpool. He came back earlier than what he actually should have done. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was obviously extremely difficult time for them. But he was a wonderful, wonderful guy. And I loved him so much. And I did it such a sad day when he died.
Yeah, I'm glad the Klopp, the cop did, you know, did him proud that day. He, you know, deserved it. Yeah, he's one of my favourite managers. He just, you know, started off rocky, obviously. You know, the two managers was no way going to work. I've never heard of two managers. It just wasn't. And I think...
You can imagine my... I was working for Radio City the night before Roy resigned. And we were playing Tottenham in the League Cup at Anfield. You got beat 3-1. But I'm doing the Radio City. And I can remember at the end of it, and I'm going through the game and I'm looking down at the dugout. It's like Roy and Gerard are sitting. They might as well have been a mile apart because there was no togetherness. There's no bond. There's nothing between them. And I'm looking down. I'm saying on it that it's echoing what's going on the bench. It's on the pitch. There's no togetherness. So after the game, the guy went, "Well, what do you think, Phil?" Well, I went off into a spiel, not a rant. I just went to where my football club is at. I saw these, you know, two men making this joint manager thing just does not work. People will be working against one another. Roy'd been there for quite... I went on and gave this big speech and I was thinking, oh, we're plumbing the depths now. So the next day, we were there getting together as legends down at the bottom, the pits, down at the bottom of Everton Valley. We were training together. And I got a phone call. It was Peter Robinson. I thought he was going to give me a bollocking. I thought he was going to say, "What are you doing this?" And he went, "Are you free?" And I went, "Yeah, why? What's up?" And he said, "Can you come to a meeting?" And I said, "Well, yeah." And he said, I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, Roy's just resigned and we'd like to have a chat with you." So I was thinking, oh my goodness. So I had to put my kit back on, my clothes back on, and I had to go to David Moores' house. So that was a wonderful moment for me. It was really special.
It must have been a proud moment. I mean, obviously with Gerard's health issues, but being manager while he was, you know, recuperating, I mean, again, you know, winning the European Cup as captain, but being the, you know, basically vice manager for that time.
Well, do you know something, Daz? You go back now, you're talking about me going into Liverpool as a 15-year-old under Bill Shankly, absolutely idolising our manager of our football club, and being able to go back to Liverpool, not knowing what was going to happen to Gerard Houllier with his heart issues. And I was manager, October the 13th, 2001, I'm manager of Liverpool Football Club for 6 months. I'm doing the same what Bill Shankly did. Mm-hmm. So I've done it all. I've gone from sort of player, captain, reserve team manager, and then now sort of assistant manager. Now I'm sort of manager of Liverpool Football Club. And that pressure because of what happened to Gerard was enormous. You know, and there was people straight away who were going, "Oh, can Phil Thompson hold this together? Can he? Is he good enough? Is he not?" Now, as I said to you, I was very clever football-wise. I was very, very shrewd. And it was not a problem. Talking to the media was not a problem. I'd worked for Sky for 6 years. That helped. But having that opportunity to pick the side. And it was funny because the first game, God bless all those people in Kiev at the moment, we were playing Dynamo Kiev. So what happened to Gerard against Leeds on the Saturday? On the Sunday, we were flying out to Kiev. So I had to take the team. Houllier was still in the operating theatre on Sunday morning. I'm now with the team taking them to Kiev for this game. So, of course, now all of a sudden I'm there. Houllier was wonderful with his team talks. I've now got to give a team talk. I've got to pick the team. Got to make sure everything is right. And I said to Sammy Lee, if I've got to be manager, you've got to be like my assistant. So I want you to be the narc. I want you to be the shouter and all that, because I've got to be thinking what's going to happen next, what the substitutes are going to be. So, but the team talk was so impressive. I thought, what can they do different? So when I give the team talk, pick the team on one flip chart, then I had all my tactics and everything on this side. And I went like that and I flipped the pages over like that, and in big words, I had it, "Do it for the boss," just in big words, right in this flip chart. trying to sort of get into this, but into this as well. And I think it was a big moment, I think, sort of to the players. And I used it then on every single game from then until Gerard came back against Roma. I did exactly, but in different words, I would put something on about the boss, his well-being, him thinking about you, you thinking about them. So I used that as my motivation. So the first 10, 11 games, I think I won 10 and drew one of the first 11 games, which is quite two manager of the months, believe it or not.
More than Klopp. Now, you had so many, you know, personalities in that squad during your time. You know, we know the antics of Bruce and everything, the seriousness of Suey. Who was your, you know, who was the funny, the real funny man in that squad?
Well, it was probably the funny one was Terry Mac. Terry McDermott was, he was such good fun all the time. You know, when you get a certain character in that dressing room, is that, and the lads all called him the legend, because of him just, and he would have us laughing and joking. Terry was incredible, because Terry could, he'd be one of them. He was probably the best drinker at the football club. Quite a few of us weren't far behind. But Terry would be great, but he'd come in the next day, and if we had to do some runs, Terry would be out at the front, running, beating everybody. He was such a fitness fanatic. But what a player he was. But he kept us entertained probably every day. It's like Jamie Carragher. Now, I know he's on the television and he does all those things, but when I was assistant manager, seeing the characters in the dressing room, Carragher was like that all the time. He could be there. He was as sharp as a tack, taking the mickey, winding people up. You needed that in the dressing room. And that's why in those early days with Houllier is that Carragher wasn't playing as much. But Gerard told Carragher, he says, you need to take care of yourself a lot more. If you do, I love you. I value you. Not only on the pitch, in the dressing room, but you take care of yourself a bit more. You've got a long time at this football club. And so it was. And I don't think Carragher, without Houllier, I don't think Carragher had played anywhere near as long as what he would have done. Mm-hmm. But Terry Mac, going back to the Terry Mac thing, it was a pleasure day in and day out. I mean, me and him became best mates.
Nah, he's definitely a legend. And it's, you know, you see the comparisons with players from your generation to the players now, you know, with the likes of Virgil and Hendo in the team. You need those, you know, strong personalities, but also they have a joker too.
I think that's always, you've got to enjoy everything what you're doing. And I think you see clubs who, when they're not enjoying it, and you can see some bad influences in dressing rooms, which leads to bad decision making. And we're seeing Manchester United at the moment, we're seeing Everton at the moment, who decision making, bad apples in dressing rooms, and it festers. And particularly with Manchester United now trying to get, I see a lot of Manchester United in the way we were for many years, searching for those proper players. And as you say, with the likes of Virgil and Jordan and Millie, you know, you've got proper people there at the top of the game who are, and it's great for sort of young Harvey Elliott, Curtis Jones, it'll be for Fabio Cavaglio. These players coming through, to have people like that who will put them in place and make sure. We had that when youngsters were coming through, your Ronnie Whelans, your Sammy Lees, who were all coming in. It was like unwritten rules in the dressing room is how you behaved. And I had that same thing when I was breaking through with the likes of Tommy Smith, with the likes of Emlyn Hughes. You had certain rules. Players love to sort of enjoy themselves, having a drink or anything, but you knew when it stopped and when you got serious on the pitch. And I think that's what our football club is enjoying at the moment. I'm so glad that Millie has signed for another 12 months. It had been a massive error of judgment. Again, we say of all the good things which has happened, which Jürgen signing, Mo signing, Darwin Núñez, Millie is again another one, which obviously for the next 12 months, he's going to be there as a player.
Well, that's the thing too. We've got to give credit to FSG for tying down a lot of the contracts last summer. And then also with Milner, you know, this season. I don't think they really get the credit that they deserve at times. Just because they have made mistakes. I think every owner makes mistakes. It's how they've dealt with them. They've basically turned around and went, you know, we've made the mistake. Let's move on. And I just think, you know, we live in the Twitter generation now where everybody can show their opinion online. They can take videos and everything. And, you know, again, I'm from the old school, same with Steve, you know, grew up in the 70s. I wish there was no Twitter. I wish there was no, you know,
absolutely
all that. You know, I wish you could put your camera down and actually just watch the match instead of, you know, I understand with people, you know, that's the first time at Anfield, you know, you want to record it, but record it for the first 5 minutes and put the damn phone down. But yeah, I think, you know, The whole situation again with Mo Salah, the contract situation, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes. You know, as a fan, we're all fans. You know, it doesn't matter if you play for Liverpool, you're a fan of Liverpool Football Club. We wanted it done in January. You know, we wanted it done in February, March, but negotiations take time, just like Klopp says. And
it's not a small deal.
Yeah.
As this is probably the biggest deal which has been done in our history of our football club. You know, we've had some incredible things. You know, Rushi coming back to our football club, signing of Suarez, the signing of Torres. We've had incredible deals which have been struck, but nothing that has been put together for Mo Salah. And yes, it's quite the extreme what he's gone to. But as we said, to try and get and pay the money for a striker, £100 million plus, is going to probably, it'll cost you more than what we're giving, Mo. So, yes, hopefully he's still got 5 years, 3 years plus, hopefully, that he's going to be doing. But it takes time to do these deals. So for Michael Edwards, who's probably working on the deal before Julian Ward took over, these guys, along with Mike Gordon, they've took the time. They've structured the deal, which is going to benefit both parties. And it has to benefit both parties. But yes, FSG have made the mistakes. The European Super League was ill-fated and got rightly decried. And I think if they'd have been managed to speak to a couple of other people before making that decision, I think they'd have gone, ugh. But I think it came from the very top, who didn't really understand the ticketing situation that they had, the prices and things. So there has been, but they learned from it, and they learned quickly. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think. And they apologized in a good manner. Not like Hicks and Gillette. What they did was truly, oh my goodness, thank goodness that we didn't sort of have too long with them. But our football club is in good hands, and we're looking at it. We're a massive, massive football club. Ourselves and Manchester United, the biggest in world football. And you look at where we stand at the moment, and we are going, and from what I was getting told, as good on the football pitch as we are off the field, I think in the next financial year, I think we will see our football for the very first time will go above Manchester United, which that takes some doing, Daz. Without me, I'm not a businessman at all.
Yeah.
But from what I'm being led to believe, that is why we're in good hands. And you have to have a good off the field to make sure that the people on the field can feel good to play the football.
Yeah, I think we're one of the best run clubs in the world. You know, I get tired of we've won the net spend championship. I mean, I try and tell people, would you want to be Man United, who spend, and look at them now? I mean, Ronaldo wants to leave. That's the thing. We've kept players like I have many conversations on Twitter about, you know, people talking about we should have let Milner go. I think the younger generation don't understand what Milner and the likes of Hendo actually bring to this team off the pitch as well.
Yeah.
Just like you were saying, these youngsters, Elliot, they love players like that and they can learn from them.
Gaz, there's always a timing to things like these when you have the changeover of players. And I just don't feel the time is right for Millie to give that side of it up, the playing side. To me, I still think he's played a big part. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think we will see probably in January, more like next summer, we will see the midfield evolving. As we've seen our strike force, going back 18 months, Daz, mm-hmm. we were like that. We were thinking, oh my God, we've got sort of Sadio, Bobby and Mo. Where do we go after that? We've got Divock and we've got Minamino and you're going, does that fill you full of what happens if something happens with one of these front lads? Then we've seen Jota come in. Then we see Luis Diaz. Some wonderful vision and plan that our people have. So they are looking for the well-being, the continuity. And it's the same with Millie. Maybe they looked at Millie and structured in his deal as well. And they've gone, no, it's not right. It's not quite right. We need him to be here, especially if Jordan, because he's getting a little, maybe he gets a few of his injuries. You need this guy who's going to be there as lieutenant. So I think the structure of the club is in wonderful hands, off the field as well as the manager and his staff.
Squad-wise, are you happy?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You always want more. I'm like any fan, but I must commend the club with what they've done. I really feel like I would have thought maybe 2 weeks ago we had the Salah thing was already in the bag. Mm-hmm. You know, you've seen him on that in Mykonos with his shirt over his shoulder. You can't be telling me that it ended up going and being done. I think a couple of weeks ago that was done. Mm-hmm. But what they realised, Sadio was going and they thought, we don't want to sort of release the signing of Mo Salah, and they knew that Sadio was going, and then we've had it, and then everybody go, oh, why Sadio gone? Why couldn't he do the deal for it? So they've gone, right, we'll do the deal for Sadio. That's done, he's gone. Now we're gonna give. So we're all feeling a lot happier. We're going into the pre-season today. Mo's done, everybody. I think they've got that side of it spot on.
Well, I mean, with the Manny, I'm sure didn't tell Klopp he was leaving right after the Champions League. I think he's known for a while. That's why Diaz was going to be brought in the summer, but then Spurs showed interest and then Liverpool went, we're getting him now. I think Diaz was Manny's replacement anyway. So
I think they've always been thinking ahead. That's the great thing about Michael Edwards and Julian Ward. That's why we have a vision. We have a plan. You said before that we're way ahead of any other football club in our recruitment. And it's because of that. And because once you've got a plan and you work towards that, you don't change. And I'm quite sure if it couldn't have been done with Mo, they probably wouldn't have done it. And they've said, no, we have to, it happens. But they will have had a vision for life after Mo Salah if he'd have moved on. And I'm so glad that it's not. And as I say, we're now all looking forward to the start of the season.
Oh, which starts today in training.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Back today, 4th of July.
That's right.
Phil, I want to leave you with this, a quote from the great Bob Paisley about you, which I love. I regard Phil as one of the best possible examples of a true professional. His great asset as a player is his ability to read the game. He showed that gift even as a teenager. He is not the biggest man physically for his role in defence, but his football brain is outstanding. Can't get better than that from the big man.
I think Bob wasn't as eloquent as what Shanks was, but those words were sort of really nice, and it hits home everything what he says there. You know, the frame, I had to have more desire than anybody else because of my frame, because of how I was thinner than the normal centre-backs, but I could play and I could read the game. And when Emlyn Hughes and myself came together in 1973, we changed to what's now known as the Liverpool way. Is and the academy still used those things, and it was start from 73, the FA Cup 74, it was passing the ball out from the back, going round to Phil Neal, back to me, to Emlyn Hughes, to Joey Jones, and then maybe back to Ray Clements, and Ray Clements, and then pushing up to the halfway line, and Ray Clements, sweeper, keeper. Does it bring it, does it remind you of anything? Exactly as it is now. And yeah. Pep Guardiola thinks he's reinvented the wheel. And we were doing things like that. We were doing things like that back in the mid-70s, which, again, because we played it, we passed the ball around, went right through the midfield, through the front lads, is still to this day called the Liverpool way.
Well, Phil, it's been my absolute honour to have you on again. Like I told you, I never listened to my granddad's stories. I really have to go back in time. But, you know, he knows he's up there and he knows I'm listening now. So that's the main thing. But, you know, from the bottom of my heart, I really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks very much, Daz. I've enjoyed it. Nice trip down memory lane. And thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Phil.
Thank you.